You're listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.
Well, this morning we too are remembering two of the country's most celebrated poets, Máire Bhakanty and Brendan Kennelly. Here's Máire Bhakanty speaking to RTE Radio 1 in 2000, explaining why she wrote in the Irish language.
English is certainly my everyday language, and it's the language in which I write prose with ease. But the language that means most to me, I mean the language emotionally that touches me, is certainly Irish. And I feel that when I write in Irish, I write with authority. I know when I write in English that it's a pale reflection of what I could write in Irish.
So you can be more colourful, perhaps?
I can't help being colourful. I mean, that's the nature of the language. The turf smoke clings to it, you know. It is very difficult to write, at least for me, to write detached prose in Irish. And of course, detached prose is not what you want to write if you're writing poetry.
Máire Bhakanty in 2000 on RTE Radio 1. And speaking to RTE's Writer in Profile series in 1976, Brendan Kennelly explained why he was drawn to write poetry.
I would say that poetry is a sort of connection between the individual mind and all these minds and sensibilities that move outside you. The book you mentioned at the beginning, The Voices, I was trying there to connect with the world about me. Because, well, you have your inner life, I have my inner life, so has everybody. But there is also this world that's moving about you, and how do you make sense of it? Now, you try to connect with poetry, and you select images from that outer world which coincide with what you feel. And so they become kind of symbols of your own emotion. You literally create your own world.
Brendan Kennelly there in 1976. Uachtaráin na hÉireann, Michael D. Higgins, good morning.
Good morning.
It's a sad day indeed, isn't it, when we say farewell to two such significant poets and two people of such immense importance to the cultural life of this country. Your thoughts this morning, President?
Of course it is. These are two great figures that are lost to poetry, but it has been a very sad time for the arts and for culture generally. Yesterday I was at the funeral of Tony McMahon, the celebration really of Tony McMahon's life and music, and then Paddy Maloney, then there's so many. We have lost so many people, but these are two extraordinary important figures. I think that Brendan Kennelly, probably because of his commitment to sharing poetry, his commitment to performance, I think that he and people like Paul Durkin and Nulini Gonan and others going around the country created huge audiences in extraordinary places for poetry. Brendan, I had the privilege of knowing as a friend. I was listening to Gerard Daw making reference, for example, to Brendan's commitment to poetry in prisons. I filled in for him once when he couldn't make it to Mountjoy, and I read some poems myself there. But that was the kind of person he is. And when I was paying tribute to him, said that he had crafted an extraordinary place in the affections of the Irish people, I really meant it. But did so much, as I've said, to creating an audience for poetry. Again, listening to Máire Bhakanty speaking about why she's writing in Irish, that's a very, very important statement, I think, she makes of the proximity of the Irish sounds and the Irish language to nature. Every sound has a reason for it, and the words coming to her, therefore, had that authenticity. I think she was very influenced, of course, by her uncle, Pádraig de Brún. And I think that what I noted, remember, I had the privilege of meeting her, was the way in which she had a high standard, a formalism, as it were, a great commitment to the words in Irish. And she could be quite a relaxed person out of the poetry. But hers is an extraordinary contribution in so many different ways, a life of courage and a life of defying convention in so many ways.
It was in as you say, what she was saying herself there in 2000 about the Irish being the emotional language that touches her. And we were speaking to Alvin Garvey, the UCC lecturer and poet earlier, and she said that she believed that in the times that Maura MacIntyre lived in, the fact that she wrote in Irish allowed her to get away with more.
Well, I think it is certainly the case that for a long while, I remember in the early days of Radio na Gaeilge, and indeed to an extent in Teilifís na Gaeilge too, you could discuss matters in Irish that it hadn't, if you like, been caught in the web of self-censorship and formal censorship in English. That certainly was the case in relation to international affairs. But in her case, in the poet, she is very interesting insofar as that she writes very directly about sensuality, and she writes about personal feeling, and it's very revelatory. It doesn't hold anything back. There is no, if you like, evasion in it. And that's a great strength. There is pain that is expressed, but also there is feeling. And I think that is certainly the case. I think that in Brendan's case as well, I was thinking, just as you were asking me to come on about Brendan and the morning, for example, in that poem beginning, which Gerald, which you made reference to earlier, you know, he describes getting up before the light has come and walking around Dublin along Pembroke Road, and you know, he speaks about. He speaks about the like a laughing girl leaping down from the Dublin mountains, is how he describes the light coming. But Brendan had so much to give, and he gave it so generously. I think in 1980, when we were celebrating his 80th birthday in the Abbey Theatre, he was asked how would he like to be remembered, and he said he would like his poems to be remembered, and he would like them to be said out loud. And that was his deep commitment. It is why, if you like, that he was looked at and appreciated with such affection by people of all ages in all places. And then I think maybe it hasn't been given sufficient attention is the way in which he portrayed the women in his classic work I'm thinking of the Antigones and the Ismenes and so on. He was brought very strongly forward their feelings. I think again in relation to Cromwell and Judas, I agree with Gerald Dow these are very, very strong excursions into the inner feelings of the people who are protagonists in action. And again, they're very strong poems. That is the epic form, really, at its best.
We are grateful to Uachtaráin na hÉireann for joining us this morning to remember Maura MacIntyre and Brendan Kennelly.
See, that's not the normal sound you hear on Morning Ireland of a Friday, is it? Welcome back to the New York Brass Band from York. Of course, they're playing Happy, and there is a great sense of happiness here in Cork this weekend. And joining me, Fiona Collins, the chairperson of the Cork Jazz Festival Committee, and a very happy weekend for you, Fiona, getting it back. And also Pascal Sheehy, our Southern editor, who gave us that report on the reopening here earlier in the programme. Fiona, the first post-pandemic post-lockdown, because the pandemic to some large extent is still with us. So, happiness, obviously. Nervousness, was it really hard putting this jazz together?
Definitely. Happiness, nervousness, excitement, all coming together, definitely. There's always a slight apprehension about it. We'd looked at planning for the festival before the restrictions were to be lifted, so we were definitely going to do something. But then when we heard about the restrictions being lifted, we worked towards that, always with it, you know, the expectation that it might be revised. We were working towards that, but there's definitely an excitement. There's a buzz in the air in Cork again, back for the weekend, and I'm just thrilled to see it. Yeah. Really thrilled.
You can see it in the smile on your face as well. And Pascal, while there is a lot of nervousness, and Mary Favier was talking to us about that, and Paul Reid as well, you also got the sense walking around last night that this was nearly something that couldn't be held back.
Yeah, there's a balance of need going on here at the moment. There is an apprehension about reopening and things like that, but at least that's taking place in a regulated manner in nightclubs and in bars and clubs and things like that. I will remind people about the pictures we saw in this city from last summer when thousands of people were gathering in the Docklands in Cork on Fridays, Saturdays and Sunday nights in a completely unregulated fashion. Now, that was an accident waiting to happen, and I think everybody recognised that. So while there is maybe a sense of apprehension ahead of reopening, at least it's happening in a regulated fashion.
Indeed. And one of the things we were talking to Deirdre O'Shaughnessy about earlier was the various roadworks and transport works and infrastructure works that are going on here in Cork. In terms of development, what impact has lockdown had? What's the story?
Well, the changes that the roadworks, the airport redevelopment, the works even on the rail line coming into the city, that's part of a range of transformational change currently taking place in this city. And to put it in context, the sort of change that you saw in the Docklands area of Dublin in the late 90s and the early noughties, that is now taking place here in Cork to build a counterbalance to Dublin. 350 million, a third of a billion euro in state funding has been announced for the Docklands and Cork, and that will give way to 5 billion euro in over the next 20 years. And we've already seen this. This is taking place just a few hundred metres away. Number one, Albert Quay, Horgan's Quay, big office development, Albert Quay, Penrose Dock, Navigation Square. So the whole Docklands area of the city is being transformed before our eyes as we speak. On a wider level, in IDA-backed companies, there were more people employed in IDA-backed companies in Cork last year than there ever was before. It's almost double what it was in 2010, and there is every evidence. 17 investment and jobs projects already for the city. There is every evidence here that the bounce back will be quick.
Indeed, and that's something indeed many people here will be looking forward to, but looking forward to more immediately this weekend, Fiona. Tell us about some of the highlights and tell us what will be the same, what will be different this jazz.
So this weekend we have 60 venues taking place, or 60 venues taking part, I should say. We have acts like Matthew Halsall, Hypnotic Brass Ensemble taking place in the Opera House and in the Everyman. You have all the different pubs across the city taking part. For me, one of my favourite parts of the weekend is actually the jazz bands on the street, the likes of the lovely band you hear behind us. You know, they're going to be playing pop-ups and on the stage in Emmett Place over the weekend. So, you know, just coming into the city and getting a feel for the festival and seeing the bands on the streets is definitely one of my favourite parts of the festival.
What's the economic bounce it gives to the city of Cork?
It's around 25 million. It's really hard to put a figure on because, you know, there's the official spend from the budget, from the festival and what that is. And then you have, you know, that indirect spend as well, what happens in the rest of the city over the weekend. So it's very hard to put a figure on, but it's estimated to be around 25 million.
And it is something, I mean, you come here these jazz weekends in Cork, Pascal, they are just something unique, aren't they?
And they're quite unique. It's something that's intrinsic to the city. We didn't have one last year, and there's a huge sense of anticipation in terms of what we're going to see over the next 2 or 3 days.
Well, thank you both for joining us to talk about it this morning, and we hope indeed that everybody has a safe as well as a very happy next couple of weekends. Thank you to our band, the New York Bass Band. They'll be playing here at the Jazz over the weekend, and they'll play us out now.
We're going to just
start this morning here in Drogheda in County Louth. We're in the Mill Enterprise Centre, a co-working centre for start-up businesses. Shortly we'll be getting political reaction to the latest announcements, but we're going to talk first of all to Dr. Ian Coonahan. He's a respiratory consultant and clinical director at the Department of Medicine at Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital here in Drogheda. Thanks very much for joining us this morning. You're also the hospital's COVID lead. What's the current situation?
Good morning, Rachel, and thanks for asking me to come on. I guess the current situation is the hospital's entering into its busiest time of the year. And at the moment, we've 23 patients admitted with COVID-related illness. So that represents 10% of the medical beds within the hospital. And, you know, this is a time of year with increasing normal respiratory illnesses where we tend to overflow those beds already into the surgical wards, sometimes the gynecology wards. And it's concerning that we're taking up essentially what is a large medical ward just purely with COVID. So it's very busy in the hospital at the moment. We have large presentations to the emergency department on a daily basis. I think August overall was the busiest hospital for unscheduled care that we've ever had.
Really? Why was that, do you think?
Well, I think we've just had, a year and a half of people mm-hmm. having poorer access to the healthcare that they've been looking for. They've possibly tended to migrate towards the emergency department where, when they're not able to get what they need or unwell and need acute attention. We've also, I think you've seen in the media last week about the presentations of children within the hospital, and we've a paediatric emergency department. So that's been incredibly busy in the last number of weeks as well.
And typically now, the non-COVID patients, what are they coming to you with?
Well, they're coming in with the usual medical complaints. So people who are older and frailer with minor medical illnesses maybe, but that knock them off their baseline where they're not able to look after themselves at home, or their family aren't able to look after them at home because they've got a decompensation of a chronic condition mm-hmm. or an infection on top of their other comorbidities and frailty. And the usual respiratory illnesses, people coming in with pneumonias, flare-ups of their asthma, COPD, that's what I tend to see. People present with, bad illnesses like cancers and things as well throughout the year. So the usual things.
I gather you've had a case of flu. And I think last year, didn't we have a winter almost entirely without flu? But this year, there are early signs that it's out there.
Yeah, well, I just got notified, that our first laboratory positive case of influenza this week, I think it was 2 days ago. And so that really is a concern because I guess while we've seen an uptick in the ordinary viruses such as RSV, particularly within children, and maybe a little bit earlier than usual this year, we are I've been hoping that there wouldn't be as big a flu season this year and that maybe we'd get away with it again. But I think it just highlights how important it will be for people to get the influenza vaccination, particularly people who thought maybe they didn't benefit from it last year. I think this year it's going to be really important to get that.
Is there a danger? I mean, you're obviously very busy already and we're very early on in the winter season. Is there a danger that all of this is going to have a knock-on effect and that operations will have to be cancelled?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's always a risk. I mean, we work in, as I say, we tend to become just overflow during the winter months, typically with medical admissions and people ending up spending more time in the emergency department and the patient experience time extending during that time, having to flow into surgical beds. We've been fortunate enough to have a colleague join us from the NHS. He's worked in the NHS for the last 10 years, and he was meeting me as clinical director and asking me, where's the space that we open the beds for the winter months for the additional capacity, because that's the norm. but that's just not something that we have access to.
Yeah. How have the past 18 months affected the hospital? I mean, it's been pretty much non-stop, hasn't it?
It's been busy, and I think we're getting to a time where the people that have, you know, really, you know, dived into this and just worked through it and given their all to it are getting really burnt out, you know, particularly over the summer months. I've seen that. I think we've noticed within the hospital that when we get a big upsurge in, you know, COVID cases where our ICU is full and we're working at a ward level with patients who really we would prefer to have in an ICU or HDU environment, that it takes a huge toll on the nurses and doctors and other health and social care professionals looking after them. I think on our respiratory ward, after this wave at the beginning of the year, between March and July, we saw 24% of our staff nurses move on. So,
what, they just had enough?
So I guess there'll be a natural turnover within any ward, but it's been the highest turnover of any ward within the hospital. So that just shows the toll that it's taking on those staff, because we've been really fortunate to have excellent nursing staff, you know, throughout the hospital, but the ones that I've been working with over the last 18 months I've been really proud of. And so it's sad to see them feel that they need to move to other jobs, and I'm sure that's related to the stress and the toll that it's taken on them.
Dr. Ian Cunahan, COVID lead at Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital here in Drogheda, thank you very much for joining us.
The first race equality study in universities and colleges here has found that staff from ethnic minorities are much more likely to earn significantly less than white Irish staff. The study was carried out by the Higher Education Authority, which surveyed over 3,000 staff. Dr. Lucy Michael is the co-author of the report, and she's with us now. Dr. Michael, thank you for joining us on Morning Ireland. Let's talk about pay first of all. You looked at who earns less than €60,000. What did you find?
Well, we found that 66% of ethnic minority staff were on a salary at that rate, which is far higher than either those that we described as white Irish or white other. We use census categories for that. And pay is really indicative of a much wider picture in this, and it's the first time it's been captured, which is why this report is so important.
And were there similar findings on those who earn a higher level of money, those who earn more than $75,000?
Yes, and what's quite interesting, I suppose, is that you get a tiny blip at the very top end where you get some international recruitment to the highest professorial and management posts, but they're still a very tiny number in the larger sector. What's also interesting is at the very bottom, at those under 30,000, there's actually no difference across the different groups.
Okay.
So it's really as you start to move up the scale that we really see those gaps widening significantly.
And then the types of employment, you studied that as well and asked questions. And what did you find in terms of those on contract and those who were given staff positions?
This was something we were really interested in, given anecdotal evidence across the sector. We found overwhelmingly that this was a picture that white Irish staff were much more likely to be in full-time permanent contracts than those who were white other or from ethnic minority groups.
So what are your conclusions then at the end of this study, Dr. Michael?
Well, this study not only talks about pay and roles, it also talks about experiences of unfair treatment and discrimination. It talks about the perception across all staff groups from all ethnic backgrounds of what a picture of race equality looks like in their universities, colleges and institutes of technology. And what we've really seen is that these institutions are not keeping pace with change in Irish society, where they should actually be in a leadership position, showing other institutions how to do it. They're not demonstrating a real commitment in terms of making those policies visible and functional. They're not keeping up with the mechanisms to report racism after it's happened, when that's abuse or discrimination. They're not dealing adequately with transparency in recruitment. Mentoring programs are largely absent. There is right across the spectrum of activities in universities, colleges and institutes of technology, there is a need to address race equality. It's not happening naturally. It's not keeping up with the pace of change. And I think the biggest finding for me from this report is actually, in this respect, all institutions are behind their own staff in anticipating what changes required, a huge wave of support in this for those institutions to make changes with huge support from their own staff. And it's now time for leadership in those institutions to step forward, to acknowledge race inequality exists, as the staff in this survey do, and to follow their own staff's recommendations for change around recruitment, around support within academic careers and other careers within those institutions, around the kinds of roles that people operate and how those are given credit and visibility with the institution. And really keep pace with what's happening across Europe. There have been a number of reports in the international landscape on this. Some Irish universities have been part of those reports, but really the Irish higher education landscape isn't keeping pace with this. The HEA Centre has been leading, obviously, on gender inequality, and there has been quite a number of changes in regard to that. This now really moves us into the next phase of action. On equality, diversity and inclusion, we've recommended an intersectional approach so that that good work that started on gender equality is expanded to consider race and ethnicity, so that they don't become competing agendas, if you like, but to continue that work on really positive diversification of the university landscape and colleges and institutes of technology, and the embedding of policies and practices which disrupt the discrimination that's emerged there as a result of historic practice, if you like.
Yeah, because is it fair to say it's not reflective of the student populations?
It's certainly not reflective of the student population. That student population is increasingly diverse. And I suppose one of the reasons for that is there aren't the kind of barriers to the student body becoming diversified that there are for the staff body becoming diversified. There's a really large untapped pool of potential amongst academics, qualified academics in Ireland. We know that academics from ethnic minority backgrounds are not finding out about the jobs. They're finding out about them too late. They're not getting through to interview stage. When they are, their qualifications are being discounted in the selection process, both pre and post interview, and they're simply not getting those jobs. That's why they're ending up in this casual, precarious contracts.
That's fascinating.
Many have moved outside academia altogether.
And very crucial report. Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Lucy Michael, who co-authored that report on behalf of the Higher Education Authority.
Into the US now, and the Hollywood actor Alec Baldwin fired a prop gun that killed a cinematographer and wounded the director on a film set in New Mexico. Anusha Sakui of the LA Times has been telling me more.
So, as you mentioned, this film, it's called Rust. It's a Western that's been shot in New Mexico. What's being reported and about from the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office is that the actor, Alec Baldwin, who is also a producer on that film, fired a prop gun on the set, which killed the director of photography called Helena Hutchins, who was 42, and injured the director, Joel Souza, who is 48.
This is quite shocking. Is there any further information on how this could happen?
There isn't at the moment. All we know at this time is that no charges have been filed, but the sheriff's office is interviewing, you know, witnesses. Production is obviously halted now on what was a, you know, low budget movie which began filming earlier this month.
What are people in the movie industry saying around the use of prop guns? People will be surprised to think that a prop gun shooting blanks would have the capacity to kill someone.
Obviously, it's rare, and there are a lot of safety protocols around weapons on set that should keep people safe. There have been terrible accidents on film sets. You know, back in 1993, Brandon Lee, the son of the late martial arts star Bruce Lee, he died hit by a 44 caliber slug while filming a death scene for the movie The Crow. Bruce Lee's daughter Shannon Lee actually paid a tribute to Hutchins and Souza today after hearing of the incident, and she said, you know, no one should ever be killed by a gun on a film set. It's just, we don't know what's happened on this film set, and how it's possible that these two could have been injured or killed.
And we have to await further investigations. Alec Baldwin, of course, a hugely successful actor who's reached, I suppose, a whole new audience in recent years with his impersonations of Donald Trump on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously a household name, and he was producing this movie and so would have had a heightened role in it. And, you know, obviously is, you know, well known for, you know, his roles on SNL as, you know, doing the Donald Trump impressions recently, but also for his NBC show 30 Rock on NBC, which he and Tina Fey made into a hilarious comedy.
Anousheh Sakhoui of the LA Times there joining me a little earlier.
A former British soldier who'd been on trial for the attempted murder of a County Tyrone man almost 50 years ago has died. Dennis Hutchings had been on trial in Belfast, charged in connection with the killing of John Pat Cunningham back in 1974. Yesterday, the judge was told that he'd contracted COVID. Our Northern correspondent Conor McCauley is on the line. Conor, how did this news emerge?
Good morning, Rachel. Well, this trial had actually been running for about 2 weeks, but it had only been sitting for 3 days, each of those weeks to facilitate Mr. Hutchings, who needed treatment for chronic kidney disease and a heart condition. The trial had actually been adjourned last Friday because Mr. Hutchings felt unwell. And yesterday, when we came to monitor the trial again, his counsel revealed that he'd tested positive for COVID on Saturday and was self-isolating in his Belfast hotel room. His condition then appears to have worsened through the day, and we understand that he was taken by ambulance from his hotel to the Mater Hospital in Belfast, where he died yesterday around tea time. The news emerged then when a veterans group, which has been supporting him during his trial, put the news on social media with the full support of his family yesterday evening.
Tell us about Dennis Hutchings. What was he accused of?
Well, Dennis Hutchings was 80, a former member of the Life Guards Regiment. He went on trial in early October for the attempted murder of a man called John Pat Cunningham in Benburb in 1974. Now, John Pat Cunningham was a 27-year-old man with learning difficulties. We were told that he was very scared of the army and that, in fact, when he met them, he would often try and hide. That is what appears to have happened on this occasion. He was walking on a country road near his home when he was met by a mobile convoy of Army Land Rovers. He took to the fields and started to run. A number of soldiers then followed him into the field. A number of shots were fired and Mr. Cunningham was hit several times. Now, Mr. Hutchings was leading that patrol. He was one of two soldiers said to have fired their rifles. There were no bullets recovered, so there were no forensics to sustain the murder charge, and that's why he was on the charge of attempted murder.
This isn't an outcome that anyone could have wanted. Has there been any political reaction?
There has. There's been reaction overnight, a lot of, pardon me, on social media, particularly from unionists around the, I suppose, the appropriateness of these kind of legacy cases involving elderly army veterans. The DUP leader, Geoffrey Donaldson, said the whole case raised serious questions, not just the decision to put a man who was obviously elderly but also quite ill on trial like this, but Mr. Donaldson was also questioning the robustness of the evidence on which the entire case had hung. The UUP leader, Doug Beattie, he's called for a full and thorough independent review. He actually said, did this trial hasten Mr. Hutchings' death and did it meet the evidential and public interest tests? And then Michelle Gildernew, the Sinn Féin MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone, that's the constituency that would cover the area in which Mr. Cunningham was shot. She said last night on social media, yes, of course, there's a grieving family here in the case of Mr. Hutchings, but people shouldn't forget that the family of John Pat Cunningham are still grieving 47 years after he was shot by soldiers, and that grief knows no bounds.
Conor, thank you for that. Conor McCauley there in Belfast.
The Environmental Protection Agency has published its 2020 report on Ireland's carbon emissions, and as their DG Laura Burke told Mary earlier, lockdown resulted in an almost 16% drop in carbon emissions from transport. Energy emissions also down nearly 8% due to the ending of peat fuel generation. But because we were staying at home, the greenhouse gases from our homes were up 9%. Agricultural emissions also up slightly, as was the side of the dairy herd. So all in all, thanks to lockdown, our carbon emissions were down 3.6% last year. But is that anywhere near enough? Not so, says our next guest. She's Dr. Hannah Daly, lecturer in energy systems at UCC. An awful lot of data here, Hannah Daly. What does it add up to as far as you're concerned?
What it means is that we're far from being on track to meeting our Paris Agreement obligations. The UN Secretary General said that climate is a code red for humanity and that we're at the verge of an abyss. And that's not just rhetoric. The Dáil has declared a climate emergency, and young people who I lecture are frightened, they're angry, and they feel powerless because they didn't cause this climate issue, but they're going to have to deal with it, they're going to have to solve it, and we need to show them that we're meaningfully going to deal with this. The 3.6% reduction in emissions last year is only half the progress that we need to make every single year to meet our climate obligations. The Climate Change Advisory Council is about to announce its first set of recommended carbon budgets between now and 2030. And irrespective of what that number is, we have to remember that we're already in the first carbon budget period. So no matter what happens, each tonne of carbon that's emitted now takes away from our collective carbon budget.
And the burden of cutting carbon is going to have to be shared between sectors. Now, one of the controversial sectors here in terms of that burden sharing, of course, is agriculture. And you look at, you know, the increase, slight increase in emissions last year, increase from dairy as well. But the dairy herd has increased 45% in the past decade. Is that sustainable?
It's absolutely not. Agriculture accounts for nearly 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions now, and they're going in completely the wrong direction. There was an increase in emissions last year. The pandemic didn't touch that. And they're backing themselves into a corner, in my opinion, on the size of the national herd. By the way, there is no such thing as a national herd. These are private assets held by enterprises. Even though they're very heavily publicly subsidised, they are... There is no national herd. Yeah. So we need to, farmers are also at the front line of climate change. They'll be the first ones to feel the effects of climate change when it does come to Ireland, and it is going to come to Ireland. There's a huge opportunity for agriculture to diversify and become a meaningful part of being a low energy economy, tree planting, tourism, and so on.
And you mentioned the Climate Advisory Council, and we are waiting for their report, and we are waiting to see these carbon budgets, and there'll be a lot of fallout from that, obviously, between the various sectors. Shouldn't this have all happened sooner?
Well, things take time, and policies are being made.
Do you read anything into the delay then in seeing this climate action plan?
Well, four new members of the council were appointed just last week, so I think they need time to get their feet under the table because it's a big weighty responsibility for them to recommend carbon budgets. So I'm not surprised it will take a little bit more time.
And there's going to be quite some reaction, isn't it, when those carbon budgets come out? And given that we've fallen so short on meeting our targets up to now, you know, how do we stop being climate laggards?
Well, we have to face the reality. And the reality is that in Ireland, we're living far beyond our means. If everybody in the world emitted the same amount as the average Irish person, the world would already have warmed by 3 degrees. That would bring huge catastrophe. So actually doing our part means everybody coming together, social solidarity, in the same way that COVID happened. So we all came together, we trust the science, and we believed the solutions were fair. And that same sort of big societal effort is needed now to meet the carbon budgets and meet our obligations.
It's a timely point. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland, Dr. Hannah Daly, lecturer in energy systems at University College Cork.
Shakespeare in the Heart is the theme of this year's Wexford Festival Opera, which gets underway today. This year there'll be live stage action with limited capacity. Last year the event was online. Una Kelly is in Wexford for us this morning. The festival is back, Una. What are people saying about the return now to live on-stage opera in their town?
Well, Mary, most people here seem to take the return of the festival as some kind of return to normality. And I'm just standing here inside the National Opera House in the town. And like stages and concert halls across the country, it's been fairly silent for more than 18 months. But that all changes today because it is the start of the Wexford Festival Opera running until the 31st of this month. And the festival is also celebrating its 70th anniversary this year. There will be some differences from what people might remember in the past, though. There won't be the big fireworks display to open the festival, and there'll be limited capacity, of course, for audiences. Now, we'll hear more from Randall Shannon, the festival executive director, in a moment about all of that. But first, let's hear the thoughts of some people in the town. I've been asking them if they're looking forward to the festival's return.
Very much so, yeah. It's our first year living in Wexford, so very excited about getting to see the kind of the liveliness of the town and being involved in it. So yeah, really looking forward to it.
Do you have any reservations about the festival happening when cases are rising again?
To be honest, I don't pay much attention to the numbers and things like that. I just kind of do my own thing, be safe.
It's always a great time in the town, and it's for us, it's our first time living back in Wexford, and first time living in the town, so it's going to be great to be in the middle of it all.
Yeah. Are you from around here? Do you have any good memories of the festival in the past?
Yeah, I can always remember the fireworks night. It's a traditional start of the festival, so that's a kind of a touch point in the calendar for us for many years. A big night on the quays with the big display.
Now, it won't be the same this year. They won't have the fireworks display, and there'll be limited capacity for some things. Do you think that'll put a dampener on the festival, or do you think people will be just happy something's happening?
Yeah, I don't think it'll dampen it really, because it's just great to have a festival again rather than kind of waiting for it to come back around.
For kids growing up, we all grew up with that, looking forward to the few firecrackers that went off on the night.
Do yourself or any other people in Wexford, you know, maybe feel a bit of caution around having large events when case numbers are rising?
No, because most people will, in the case of anything like that, it's a sit down. You go in, you wear your mask, you do as I am now. You wear your mask and look, we have to keep living as well.
Yeah, happy it's back. I won't be going this year because I'd be a bit nervous, but I'm definitely happy it's back. Yeah.
You say you'd be too nervous to go this year?
Yeah, just to get into crowded areas and things like that. I'd be a bit more nervous about that.
Yeah.
Because I've worked from home, so I haven't been around people that much. But if you want to go, it's your choice. You can go, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm delighted it's back.
That was the thoughts there of some people in Wexford about the return of the festival. Now I'm joined by Randall Shannon. He's the festival's executive director. Randall, it must feel good to have live performances again in the 70th anniversary year.
Oh, absolutely. It's exciting and a huge relief. This is the first time we've appeared before a live audience in 2 years. Last year there was a festival, but it was entirely online. And now our artistic team, production team and management team have brought it all together, done a fantastic job. We're ready to open the doors and let the audience in to be entertained.
Now, it still isn't back to normal. Of course, there's limited capacity. What other public health measures did you have to bear in mind?
Well, we've been very careful about everything. We've arranged the seating so that there is social distancing in the auditorium. Vaccination certificates have to be checked as people come into the building. The entire performing and production company have been antigen tested on a regular basis over the past 6 weeks. We're very careful.
And what are the highlights of the festival?
Well, of course, all of it is a highlight. The core of the festival, as ever, is three productions, three opera productions. Operas that you might say have been forgotten from the standard repertoire. Ed Mea by Catalani opens tonight. Le Songe de Nuit d'été by Thomas and Vintermartian by Goldmark. One of them, I'd say, is certainly a forgotten masterpiece, but I leave the audience to decide which one that is. Mm-hmm. As well as that, there's a new commission by the composer Andrew Sinnott, 47th Saturday. The young artists will be presenting a production of Bellini's Capuletti e Montecchi, 10 lunchtime recitals, and a lecture by Colm Tobin.
Mm-hmm. And Randall, yesterday on Morning Ireland, we were hearing from Angela Dorgan from First Music Connect about the difficulties performers have experienced over the past 18 months. It's been tough.
It's been more than tough. It's destroying people, because a huge number of artists in the country are freelance. There's no corporate backup to what they do, and their lives have been damaged and perhaps even destroyed. People have had to leave the business, find other ways of earning a living, and the mental agonies cannot be overestimated.
But good to have at least some live performances coming back anyway. And people can find tickets at www.wexfordopera.com. And some of the performances will also be streamed on the RT Culture website, the RT Player, and RT Lyric FM if you can't make it down to Wexford in person.
The skeletal remains of six people have been uncovered during an archaeological dig in Cork City. The remains were found under Nancy Spain's pub on Barrack Street. Ciara Brett is archaeologist at Cork City Council and is on the line now. Ciara, why was the dig going on?
Well, good morning, Audrey. The site is an important regeneration project for Cork City Council. So we are constructing 32-unit social housing development on the site. So MMD Construction are on the site on our behalf. And the site is located within the former suburbs of the medieval city of Cork. And it is of important historical and archaeological significance. So all the groundworks at the site were considered to be important. So I instructed as city archaeologists that they be archaeologically monitored when construction is going on. So that's why the archaeologists were on site.
So what was found, Ciara?
So effectively, on Thursday the 7th of October last, we discovered the remains of one individual. And as a consequence of that, we have had an archaeological excavation going on the site. So we have a licensed archaeologist, but we also have an osteoarchaeologist on the site. And in the last week or so, on top of that initial one skeleton, we've discovered five more individuals on the site. Now, the remains are quite fragmentary, and it's very early days in the archaeological investigation, and it's not possible to maybe definitively date them, but they certainly predate the 19th century buildings on the site. So I think they're possibly likely 18th century or earlier.
Wow. And what was on that site well before the pub was there?
Well, there were gardens to the rear, basically from... We can see from cartographic sources, from John Roke's maps from 1750s and an earlier map from 1726, that there were structures on the site and there were large garden areas to the rear. So, and further up the street, about 500 metres away from the site we're at now, there's the site of a 17th century gallows. And again, and 200 metres away from the site, we have Elizabeth Fort, which is a 17th century fort. So there's quite a lot of... later medieval material in the area. So it's quite a historic area.
Absolutely. Are you excited by this find, Ciara?
Oh yeah, we're very excited. Like it's not uncommon to find human remains within an urban context, but it's not an everyday occurrence, shall we say. So no, we're very excited. I suppose we're excited to get the remains off the site and to get them further analysed by the osteoarchaeologist, and also we hope to date the bones by radiocarbon dating. So at the moment we have no datable evidence, as in we've no artefacts associated with the skeletal remains, so we really do need to try and date them by radiocarbon dating.
Okay, so that's next on the agenda then?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And where are they at the moment?
Oh, they're still in the ground. They're still being excavated. The site is still under investigation. So we hope that we'll be done by the end of the week. So after that, as kind of best practice in these kind of things, they're all removed from the site. And obviously, they'll be examined by the osteoarchaeologist. She kind of does visual inspections. So she can identify quite a lot of things, such as the sex of the individuals, possible age of them, whether they're adult or juvenile, and she can sometimes also identify various diseases and possibly the manner in which they died as well.
Okay, fascinating.
So there's quite a lot of information to come out of it yet.
Absolutely. Well, the best of luck to you all. Thank you very much. Ciara Brett, archaeologist at Cork City Council.
Now this morning we mourn the deaths and celebrate the lives of two of Ireland's most significant poets, Maura Vachanty and Brendan Kennelly. I'm joined now to remember Maura Vachanty by poet and UCC lecturer Alva Ní Gharbhé. But first, let's hear a few lines of Maura reading her poem Máiread as Bhaile, Margaret Away from Home.
Máiread as Bhaile, Margaret Away from Home. Chianíos Sheri Chapana, Chiris Sheri Flá Thea Teav, sararchini is grausche meher seide. Kred me lata chalin vig. Vi echten tanner huge heg. I bought 4 chops. I put 4 plates to heat before I remembered that you were gone on holidays. Believe me, little girl, it was an inkling of the bitterness of death.
Alvani Garvey, good morning to you.
Good morning.
She was a woman of extraordinary substance, wasn't she? And we will talk about her poetry, but talk to us a little bit about her background and her upbringing.
Yeah, I suppose initially I'd just like to extend my sympathies to Patrick and to Margaret and her stepdaughter Fidelma for this, I suppose, a time of great sorrow for them. But an extraordinary woman, she was born in 1922 in Dublin into a very prominent Republican family. Both of her parents were involved in the 1916 Rising. Her father, Sean McEntee, would go on to become Taoiseach in a Fianna Fáil government. Her mother, Margaret Brown, was a scholar. She taught Irish at Alexandra College and then at UCD. And later on, Moira would go on to marry Conor Cruise O'Brien. So you could say she was very much accustomed to life in the public eye. Mm.
She was a high flyer before we knew the word high flyer in this country. An academic, a diplomat, working with the United Nations.
Yeah, her own CV, it's quite remarkable really, the CV that she garnered throughout her life. As you say, the first woman to be called to the bar in Ireland, a diplomat, a scholar, a critic, and of course, most famously, a poet. And her legacy, I think, is something that we will be talking about for many years to come.
Well, let's talk about the poetry and maybe talk about it in the context of her connection to West Kerry and the West Kerry Gaeltacht.
Yes, so she would spend a lot of her summer holidays and Christmas holidays and Easter holidays in Dúnchuin in the West Kerry Gaeltacht. Her uncle, Pádraig de Brún, who was Monsignor and was president of Maynooth University, he had a house there called Tignacille. And she really absorbed the Irish language of West Kerry, that particular dialect. And she said she never remembered a time where she wasn't bilingual. I think, you know, it's quite significant that she felt that she could express things in this dialect of Irish that she perhaps never could have in this middle-class convent English that she felt that she had acquired in Dublin. So she, I think we find in her poetry in Irish that it can really challenge the orthodoxy of the time. I might give you a little sample, shall I?
Please do.
So this is from Carunti Voidin Yogoin. Biog viaunar auris thine, biog viaunar chrusna sagart, gach ni ach vesinte, idir tu agus falla. I care little for people's suspicions, I care little for priests' prohibitions, for anything save to lie stretched between you and the wall. So those lines were published in 1956 collection. So you can really tell that, you know, they would have been quite challenging for the time. And I think had they been published in English, they would most likely have been censored.
You met her, you interviewed her. How will you remember her?
Oh, she was a formidable woman. She had a fierce intelligence, and that day that I interviewed her for Cora magazine, it was with great trepidation actually that I travelled to her house in Howth. But she was so warm and so welcoming and spoke very frankly. She answered my questions with great honesty, and I really treasured that afternoon I spent with her.
And we thank you for your time this morning, Alvani Garvey, for remembering Maura Vachanthi with us.
Begin again to the summoning birds, to the sight of light at the window. Begin to the roar of morning traffic all along Pembroke Road. Every beginning is a promise, born in light and dying in dark. Determination and exaltation of springtime, flowering the way to work. Begin to the pageant of queuing girls, to the arrogant loneliness of swans in the canal.
The wonderful sound of Brendan Kennelly reading Begin. Well, we can talk now to another of our finest writers and poets to pay tribute to his friend Brendan Kennelly, Gerald Daw. Good morning, Gerald. You're very welcome to the programme, and I know that you were very close to him. How do you remember him this morning?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's a great loss to his family and his inner circle of friends in Kerry and in Dublin and elsewhere. It's a big loss. Brendan was unique. I mean, I was just thinking about him last night and this morning, and our friendship was based in Trinity, where we worked together for, 25, 30 years, thereabouts. He would swing in to the office on certain occasions and speak about something that he had been on his mind. There was a touch of genius about these kind of sort of off-the-cuff chats that we used to have. But I remember walking down O'Connell Street. We sometimes would go down and have tea and scone somewhere. And generally, a journey would take 10, 15 minutes. But with Brendan, it was half an hour, 40 minutes. He was always being stopped, and people would talk to him. He was almost completely rare at the time, insofar as that everybody knew Brendan, and he had this sort of ease. Dublin was just a village as far as he was concerned, and he used to walk around it as if it was back in Kerry, where his heart lay. I mean, he often spoke to me about Kerry and about his people there, about the landscape. It was absolutely crucial to him.
And he called himself the Kerry Babe and you the Belfast Boy. And he had such a warmth and compassion with him. And he brought people in. He included people. He almost became others in order to understand them.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that always impressed me greatly about his poems was, I mean, he had this epic reach, the poems on Cromwell and Judas. I think the big thing about Brendan was he adored the spoken verse. He loved the way in which people could articulate and express themselves through poetry. A little known feature of his life was back in the early days, probably in the late 70s, early 80s, he was instrumental in setting up the writer in prison scheme. And it was a breakthrough moment, because what he was trying to do was to give people from every kind of background, every kind of experience, the opportunity to express themselves. He had a great democratic spirit to him, and his sense of poetry was that it was an open art, that it communicated emotional feeling, and of course, the big influence on his life outside of his family and the landscape of Kerry was Yeats. He used to speak as if Yeats was literally in the room next door. He had a huge sense of intimacy with the work, and of course Kavanagh. My sense of Brendan, I can hear his voice as clear could be, the smile and the sense in which, you know, no matter what life threw at you, there was always a way through it. He was a great human being, and he came from a wonderful generation of Irish writers, Evan Boland, the Longleys, Edna and Michael Longley. There was a great flowering in Trinity in the late 50s and early 60s, and he was very much a part of it.
Absolutely. And Gerald, we heard him reading Begin at the start of our chat. Your favourite poem of his is My Dark Fathers. Would you read the first verse for us?
I could indeed. I mean, this is one of the early hits, if you like, of Brendan's writing. It's a stunning piece. My dark fathers lived the intolerable day, committed always to the night of wrong. Stiffened at the hearthstone, the woman lay, perished feet nailed to her man's breastbone. Grim houses beckoned in the swelling gloom of Munster fields, where the Atlantic night fettered the child within the pit of doom, and everywhere a going down of light.
Gerald, thank you so much indeed for paying such a beautiful tribute to your friend Brendan Kennelly, the wonderful poet who has died. Gerald Orr, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.